the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's no secret. Every single day, 10,000 of us baby boomers head into retirement. And consequently, it has become one of the number one hottest topics in the financial world today. Will you make it to retirement? When shall you retire? What's the number that you need? And of course, there's all kinds of things and technology out there to help you to get there. There's retirement planning programs, but what is a realistic number? What is the number you actually need to retire? Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Pfau from American University. And Wade, you and I were just talking prior to going on the air. There's been a number of articles that have come out recently, one in Bloomberg and also one in the Wall Street Journal. The one in the Wall Street Journal talked about these retirement calculators. I mean, you just Google retirement and you can find all kinds of calculators out there. There's robo planners. Let's talk about what these calculators actually do, because as the Wall Street Journal talked about, they really should be a starting point for a conversation. They shouldn't be the be-all to end-all. In other words, you plug a number in and it says that's the number. That may not necessarily be the case when you actually get to retirement. So let's talk about these programs.
Yeah, I mean, there was a study last year from Texas Tech University that they ran a case study for an individual through, I think, 36 different online retirement calculators. And naturally, they got 36 different answers, but it was all over the place. Some calculators said, you know, basically they're on track for a very successful retirement. Others said they're way off track. And it's a matter of the assumptions going into that, and it's a matter of just how the question is framed. I do question the way a lot of what quote-unquote traditional retirement planning is focused on, which is trying to meet some sort of retirement wealth target and to say that, well, if I determine I need to have $2 million and that's when I can retire, I think in practice things really don't work so easily and there's a lot more to the story than that. But that's really how a lot of the retirement calculators tend to function.
You and I know this, that let's say the average person can expect, I think in the statistics in the Wall Street Journal article, they talked about life expectancy, that a male age 65 today can live to age 84, a woman age 65 can live to 87, and they said 25% of people age 65 will live past 90, and 10% will live past age 95. So, you know, you're talking about a long lifespan, and you focus on this area. You know, Wade, that, you know, when somebody first retires, they go through different phases in their retirement. The first couple of years of retirement, they may want to do a lot of traveling, go on the trips they didn't have time to do when they're working. They settle into the middle years of their retirement when maybe they do less travel, they're more at home, and then the final phase of the retirement years where they can really be hit with substantial medical bills. So it's not just like one number gets you there at age 65, because your expenses are going to change throughout retirement.
Yeah, and that's one of the other assumptions a lot of times, and it's a basic assumption behind what's known as the 4% rule as well, is just retirees will want to spend an inflation-adjusted amount throughout their retirements, and research has questioned that going back to, there was an article in 2006 even called Reality Retirement Planning that was trying to push the idea that spending does decrease with age. Even before that, there was this idea of the go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go years, where just as people age, they naturally tend to travel less and spend less. And the only question is how much there might be in terms of health care that will offset some of the decreased expenditures in other categories. David Blanchett talks about the retirement spending smile, which is the idea that spending decreases for the first part of retirement, but then near the end of retirement, as health expenses pick up, spending tends to increase again, but still overall, a much lower level of lifetime spending than implied by just constant inflation-adjusted spending. So there's not one pattern that really anyone uses. There was another study by one of the large investment banks that looked at financial data, kind of the big data study. They had all the transactions and mortgages and everything for their customers or clients, and they categorized four different general types of people out there in terms of what types of expenditures they have. And it depends how much do people travel, how much today is healthcare really part of their life. Some people try to avoid the doctor at all costs and will naturally have lower health expenses. Others go to the doctors all the time. So there's different ways people can be categorized that can help to try to get better assumptions about what kind of lifetime expenditure patterns they might expect.
And the other thing, too, it's not just that you're dealing with, as the Wall Street Journal article talked about, longevity, because, you know, we have statistics and they can say a male age 65 or a woman 65 will live to X amount of years. But then you have family history. I mean, I was visiting clients this week that they're in their mid 90s. I mean, they're 95 years old. They're very lucid. You know, they have very few medical issues. You know, as we age, you're going to have some problems that arise. But, you know, the rate they're going, they can live to be centenarians. And there's a retirement home nearby where they have 10% of the people in the retirement home are over age 100.
Wow. Yeah, and I think you quoted those statistics earlier about longevity, but that's, I believe, for just the average American. And people who are listening to this podcast will tend to be more highly educated, higher income, more focused on planning. And just being focused on the long term tends to be a factor that such folks live longer, so that the statistics for the average American don't really even apply to those listening to this show. The Society of Actuaries, their data on people who buy annuities, but it's really the best kind of insight we have on more higher income, more highly educated type people. They're saying that for a 65-year-old couple, the probability that at least one member of that couple will make it to 95 is something more like 43% now. And it's going to be 50% before long, and that means that's the life expectancy at that point. So longevity is an issue, and there is a lot of family history in that, but also just over time, longevity continues to improve. So just because someone's parents may not have lived as long, well, had they been born 30 years later or whatever the case may be, they might have made it a lot longer, or in other words, their children might live longer than the parents. And there's a lot to anticipate with longevity.
You know, other issues that not only impact retirement planning, as we talked about, your expenses tend to differ as you age through your retirement process, but also it depends on market returns and when you retire, if you retire at the beginning of a bear market versus a bull market. I mean, think of what happened to people, Wade, that did a retirement plan, came up with a number, and they retired in the year 2000. And then they went through a bear market for 2 years, and interest rates were brought down dramatically. Or take, for example, somebody that retired, let's say, in the year 2007. So let's talk also about, since you're drawing down on capital when you retire, the difference of timing when you retire in a bear market or the beginning of a bear market versus a bull market could also alter your outcome as well.
Right. And historically in the United States, the lower spending rates that people could have used in their retirements happened after prolonged bull markets, because after the prolonged bull market, at least in the U.S. historical record, there's been market cycles. So you have bull markets followed by bear markets. And it's when you retire at the end of a bull market, hopefully you've been able to accumulate more wealth, but then you should be anticipating a lower sustainable spending rate from that point. And so that highlights years like 1929 and 1966, where two cases where it was the end of a bull market and it led to some of the lowest sustainable retirement spending rates. I mean, it's an issue for retirees in the year 2000 as well, that they're going to be on the lower end of the historical distribution for spending rates because it was the end of a historically high bull market and the beginning of a more prolonged bear market.
Yeah, because, I mean, there have been a number of individuals that specialize in this area, like yourself, Robert Merton at Harvard. You know, he gave an example. If you retired in the year, let's say, 2000, you had $1 million, you could have got $70,000 to $80,000 worth of income in fairly safe investments. The same cannot be said in the year 2016. $1 million, if you're sticking to safe investments, you have 10-year treasury yields at 1.5%. You have 30-year treasury bonds at 2.3%. That hardly buys you the same level of income that you would have gotten in the year 2000.
Right. And that's a big problem with traditional retirement planning, that it's focused on a wealth target because it's implicitly focused to a quote unquote safe withdrawal rate from that wealth. But the amount of wealth somebody needs to finance their retirement, that target fluctuates daily with interest rates. If interest rates go up, you don't need as much wealth. If interest rates go down, you need more wealth to meet a particular spending goal. And that's a completely relevant issue today. Bond yields are at historical lows, so you can support less income from a given asset base when you're not getting that type of interest. And We've seen these dramatic reductions in interest rates, which have helped to create capital gains on bond funds. But at some point, interest rates can't continue to fall forever. We have seen them go negative at points, but there is some sort of threshold there where they're not going to go more and more negative.
We've been talking about a couple factors here that are going to be altered throughout your retirement. We talked about, number one, investment returns. Obviously, retiring with a bull market versus a bear market is going to alter what you're going to be able to withdraw. Secondly, we have to deal with the issue of longevity because, you know, there's a higher probability you're going to live much longer and going to have to withdraw that capital over a longer period of time. And then we also talked about the realistic returns that you can get today. Obviously, when treasuries are down at 1.5% or, you know, 1/3 of the world's sovereign bonds are negative interest rates, that impacts your retirement. So, Wade, given these factors, the uncertainty of longevity, and we know the longer we live, higher medical expenses, the different phases of retirement, and then also different market returns, what is a safer approach to retirement income planning? Because we live in a different world today than, let's say, the 80s and 90s. My goodness, you could have been in bank CDs and you could live pretty well. That's not the world we live in today.
No, well, really, there's four different ways to manage the sequence of returns risk that amplifies the impacts of investment volatility in retirement. And when we start talking about things like the 4% rule, that's one of the directions that you can manage sequence risk by spending less. And then the question becomes, how low does spending have to get to be sustainable? And everything you just said is pointing to, well, spending may have to be less. People may live longer, so they have to plan for a longer time horizon. They may have to expect lower market returns, so just spending may have to be less. The other avenues, though, to manage sequence risk include having a less volatile investment portfolio. And that can involve using some sort of contractual guarantee, whether it's individual bonds or income annuities, to lock in a spending floor to at least cover the essentials in retirement. Another option is to be flexible with spending. The idea of something like the 4% rule is that constant inflation-adjusted spending. But if people have the flexibility to reduce their spending after a market decline, that helps to mitigate some of the sequence risk, and that can allow them to spend more initially. And then a fourth method to deal with sequence risk is having some sort of buffer asset outside the financial portfolio that someone can draw from after a market decline to help relieve pressure on their investment portfolio. And something I've been writing about recently in that regard would be like a reverse mortgage line of credit on a reverse mortgage being an asset somebody could use to avoid having to sell assets at a loss from their investment portfolio. So those are the four general ways to manage sequence risk. And a lot of times too much attention is put on just how low does spending have to get with the direction to manage sequence risk of just spend less.
Yeah, you know, one of the ideas that we favor in retirement planning is that, especially when a couple starts out in retirement, that they include in their budget somewhere between $8,000 and $10,000 a year for medical expenses, because studies shown that the average couple can end up spending anywhere from $230 to $260, depending on whose study you're reading, on out-of-pocket medical expenses, which includes Medicare premiums, which includes, you know, Medigap insurance, which includes out-of-pocket expenses and stays, and that doesn't even count long-term care. And we know, for example, for 30% of Americans next year, Medicare premiums can go up 22% based on your income. So these are the things you can't factor in. I want to talk about something that has gotten a bad name, and that is annuities. If you watch the cable channels, you have a couple firms that advocate that annuities are a great supplement for retirees for their income to give them greater assurance that they won't outlive their income. And then you have other firms that go on and say annuities are the worst thing anybody can do. So you have done studies, and you and others have looked at, like, a, let's say, an income annuity. What are your thoughts, and what have you found with your research?
Typically, academics like the income annuities, but nobody else really seems to like them. The insurance industry doesn't like them as much because they are the most straightforward, lowest commission, easiest to understand annuity. And then investment managers tend to not like them because they take away assets that the investment manager can charge a fee on, since it just takes it out of the investment portfolio. But an income annuity, just it straight up provide a lump sum premium to then provide a guaranteed income for life. And then it provides a unique source of returns to an individual that's not available from an investment portfolio. And that is, it's called mortality credits. People are pooling their longevity risk. You don't know if your retirement could last 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, 40 years. If you're worried about outliving your assets, you have to start planning like your retirement might last 40 years. And if your life expectancy is 20 years, well, you don't get to spend like you're going to live for 20 more years. That's, you're worried about outliving your money. But an income annuity can pay you like you're going to live for 20 years because it pools the longevity risk across the population of customers. And then those who unfortunately don't live as long subsidize those who live longer. But everyone who is worried about outliving their money can benefit from this kind of arrangement because it really provides a license to go ahead and spend. I think income annuities are a much more important tool for retirees than traditional bonds. Not to say that bonds don't have any role. Bonds can be useful as a source of contingency assets for unexpected expenses. But in terms of what can provide the income, what can reduce the volatility of the investment portfolio, or really at that point of the overall household balance sheet, I think income annuities provide a really valuable option for retirees to consider. And all the discussion about annuities being complex, opaque, high cost, that's not about income annuities. That's about other types of either variable annuities or indexed annuities. It's not about very simple single premium immediate annuities or their cousins, the deferred income annuity or the QLAC that you can now buy within a qualified plan. It's a deferred income annuity that allows you to avoid RMDs. It's longevity insurance. It's paying the premium today for income that will start in the distant future.
Yeah, it's unfortunate you bring up two things. The insurance industry doesn't like immediate annuities because they don't pay high commissions. And likewise, the money managers that attack annuities don't like them because if you give money to an insurance company, that's money that the money manager isn't able to charge fees. So you have some conflicts of interest that kind of confuse the individual that is thinking about them, because for years, Wade, when people worked for corporations and got a pension plan, much as like government workers do, where you get a percentage of your salary, basically, those were basically annuities. The company that you worked for took a pot of money, went to the insurance company and said, based on this person's age, what do they get for the rest of their life?
Mm-hmm. And Social Security is also an annuity.
And the thing is, one of the most important aspects, as you've written about so many times, is really you want to take your basic expenses, whatever they are to live, your medical expenses, your rent or your mortgage payment or whatever you're spending on food. You want a steady stream of predictable income that comes in. You don't want to be subject to the vagaries of, let's say, the stock market or bond market. So you do want something that is predictable so you never outlive that or worry about outliving your assets.
Yeah, and for some people, that's much more valuable. Others do tend to be more risk takers and may continue to behave that way in retirement and so don't want to give up the upside potential growth for those assets. But the mortality credits, that subsidy, that's an incredibly valuable aspect of annuities that, yeah, if somebody has great market returns on their portfolio, they could potentially end up being better off if they don't annuitize. But it's surprising. You have to have not just average market returns, you have to have above average market returns to be able to outpace the value you get from those mortality credits. And I think that's something that's not widely understood.
No, and when you take a look at today's stock market, where the Case-Shiller PE is at one of its highest levels and bond yields are at their lowest yields in history, that implies lower returns going forward. So if you are a risk taker and saying, well, I'll gamble and roll the dice, figuring I'll get a higher rate of return from the market, I just don't see the environment that we're in today is a market that would support that. It's not like 1981, where we had a bear market for 13 years and you could buy stocks at a PE ratio of 7, or I can remember, Wade, when utility stocks paid 14%, or you could get a 15% treasury bond. I mean, those were good years.
Yeah, and some of that really, it offsets each other. So, yeah, if you had retired in 1982, the sustainable spending rate from just a 50-50 type portfolio is almost 10%. We talk about the 4% rule, but a 1982 retiree was looking at something more like 10%. Now, just on the other hand, if you retired in 1982, it would have really been hard to save much because your portfolio would have been taking hits during those key pivotal pre-retirement years. But a lower asset base, a higher withdrawal rate versus times like today where hopefully you have a higher than average type of asset base despite some of the extreme market volatility we've had in the past recent years. But you may be looking at a lower type of withdrawal rate from whatever you've had because you should expect, at least to be conservative, lower than typical types of market returns because the stock market is at a historically high valuation level. And historically, that has been a good predictor of sustainable spending rates. And also, interest rates are low. And today's bond yield is the best predictor of future bond returns. And for somebody retiring today, sequence of returns risk means market returns in the early part of retirement matter disproportionately. So an argument that bond yields will eventually normalize, even if they get back up to their historical averages in 5 or 10 years, that's getting to be too late for somebody who's retired today and who's spending down principal because they're getting such little income from their portfolio.
Let's throw another misconception about retirement planning, and you've written about this. And that is when somebody first retires, your portfolio should be probably the most conservative, more towards income annuities, bonds, or conservative type investments. And then as you age, you should have more in stocks because you're going to need it for those expenses that are going to hit you in latter years. That's traditionally not what has been done historically. So it's almost like a reversal in thinking so that when you retire, that is the point you should be most conservatively invested because you cannot afford to take a 40, 45% hit in a bear market starting out your retirement as many retirees faced in the year 2000, 2002, and 2007, and 2009 when the S&P 500 was down 45%.
Yeah, when you reach retirement, you're at a very vulnerable point. If that's the point where your wealth is the largest, then you're the most vulnerable to absolute losses in wealth. And also your risk capacity decreases at retirement. And that just means your ability to take in a significant market decline and not have that end up impacting your lifestyle in a severe way. The ability to take those sorts of market declines in and just run with them, it becomes harder when you lose some of the flexibility that you had pre-retirement. You're now really set on a course of action where you need to sustain income from your investments, and that makes you more vulnerable. So that those years right around retirement are a really crucial time where you're not going to want to be taking too much risk and potentially jeopardizing what you have.
So, Wade, what would you advise somebody that is, let's take two situations, somebody's maybe 10, 15 years away from retirement and somebody that is retired? You know, you should have a plan, as you talk about people that are educated, that have a plan, tend to live longer because they're long-term thinking, they look at the future, they're more likely to take care of their health. How would you advise somebody to start out?
I think the starting point is to just think about the entire household balance sheet available. What's the asset base, not just the investment portfolio, but what other options are there for receiving help or support? Do you have long-term care insurance and that sort of thing? And then try to figure out how to match that to your liabilities, which include essential types of expenses, what's more discretionary in nature, what kind of potential risk do you run with unexpected expenses, either long-term care, health care, and so forth. And then what type of legacy goals do you have? And to really think about that as a starting point and then try to position assets so you can meet those liabilities, meet those goals while managing the different types of retirement risk, the longevity risk, the market risk, and the spending shocks.
Yeah. And once you say they also, just like we all know from a health perspective, every year we go and get a physical, that the plan ought to be revisited maybe at least once a year to see how you are on track. Because we do know, as we've seen in the last 16 years, markets have changed dramatically. I never thought we would see interest rates down to zero or 30-year mortgages at 3.5%. I mean, it's a different world today than it was 16 years ago.
Yeah, it is important to have those frequent interactions. One other risk post-retirement, too, is this unfortunate issue of cognitive decline, where especially as people get into their 80s or 90s, it becomes much more difficult to manage an investment portfolio and make financial decisions. So working with a trusted advisor is important. the other aspect of that too, for a couple, if one member of the couple is managing the household finances, there's the risk if that person passes away, what's going to happen to the survivor? And so, yeah, revisiting the plan, but also keeping in mind that you want to have protections built into place to the extent that it becomes more difficult for an individual to make those annual revisits to the plan in a productive type of way.
Yeah, we recently came across a case where the husband had managed the finances, husband passes away, wife doesn't understand the investment markets, and literally until the children found out what was going on with mom, she had over $500,000 in a checking account, which was getting zero. First of all, there was the risk if the bank ever went under, all of that wouldn't have been covered. But, you know, you have $500,000 getting zero versus, you know, you could have been getting at least 2 or 3% if you were in bonds. So, and it was this cognitive problem that you have as people age. They can't keep up with the markets. They may not be interested in it. Or you have a situation between a couple where maybe one individual, either the husband or sometimes even the wife, was the one that managed the finances and the investments. All of a sudden, that person's gone. What happens to the survivor? And especially if they lose much of their cognitive abilities. So, Wade, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow all the great work that you do, how could they do so, please?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I blog frequently, and kind of the central location to find everything is retirementresearcher.com. It's all one word, just retirementresearcher.com. That's my home on the internet.
Keep up the great work. You know, one thing that I would love to see people like yourself advocate is we have all these wonderful education institutions in this country, and we teach people how to go out and make a living, but we don't teach people how to manage their money with what they earn from that living. Like, we don't teach retirement planning. Think of what a different outcome we'd have today if a couple starting out of college began retirement planning at an early age, how much better off they would be by the time they got to retirement.
Yeah, absolutely. And I try to cater to individuals that are interested in learning more, but definitely getting them to pay attention, it's a struggle. Hopefully things will slowly change in that regard.
Well, listen, Wade, as always, thanks for coming on the program. All the best to you.
Yep, you too. Thanks.
That concludes my interview with Wade Fow, and a real pioneer when it comes to retirement planning, because he's just blown away a lot of these myths and assumptions that we've all made about retirement planning. And, you know, a couple of takeaways that you can walk away, and that was the subject of this week's Lifetime Income, is, you know, you should have a plan. People that have a plan stand a better chance of never worrying about outliving their assets. They tend to live longer, as Wade talked about. But you're dealing with a lot of issues today that we didn't deal. I mean, the 80s and 90s, in my opinion, were the golden years of retirement. The Social Security cost increases were going up sometimes at high single digits, double digits a year. I can remember in my early years in retirement planning, I had individuals that retired from companies and corporations or in the military, and their Social Security checks were going up at tremendous rates. Remember, CPI was 14.5% in 1980, so that meant you got a 14.5% pay increase in your Social Security. It was a period of time, as Wade talked about, in the 80s, the sustainable withdrawal rate on your assets was 10% a year. Today, it's closer to 3% a year. And as we talked about in Lifetime Income this week, definitely have a plan and modify that plan, because concentrating or focusing on what a number is, that is a meaningless number. You need to take a look at your basic expenses, your extra expenses, your medical expenses, and understand throughout your retirement years, whether you live 25 or 40 years. I was with a couple this week that spent 40 years in retirement. They're in their late 90s, still sharp as a whip. They have a few medical issues, but taking a look and modifying your plan as your personal circumstances change, as markets change, as we've seen so often happen in these last 16 years. On behalf of Lifetime Income, I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.